What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. A while back, a friend of the pod asked me what subscriptions I'd recommend for news and analysis on world politics. And it was actually a hard question to answer on the spot, believe it or not. But I've got a great answer now. Mother effin' World Politics Review. If you're a fan of Undiplomatic, you should be reading World Politics Review. It's obviously worldly. It's in the title. It's not obsessed with Trump, and it has a great mix of analysis and journalism. Also, why do you think I'm doing this pitch? World Politics Review is an official sponsor of the show, and the best way to back us right now is to back them. So give them a chance. They're offering a 25% discount subscription for Undiplomatic listeners, and if you want to subscribe to their daily newsletter, which you should, you can do it for free. Just visit wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That's wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That'll get you the free newsletter, and it'll also provide you the code for the 25% discount should you want to subscribe. So get on the train, wpr.pub/undiplomatic. Peace. What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. Full house with Jake Dello.
What's up, man?
Kiara Mitchell.
Hello.
Gabby Magnuson.
Morning.
And Pete McKenzie.
Hey.
We've got one major, this is not a shout out. This is a hotly contested discussion point, or highly controversial, I guess. Defense One, a sort of news policy website that focuses on defense in the U.S., published a pair of op-eds that are, I don't know, earth-shaking in their potential implications. One is by John Nagel and Paul Yingling, who are former Army lieutenant colonels, and Nagel used to be head of CNAS, that one of the think tanks I'm affiliated with. I never knew him or worked with him. And they argue that if Trump violates the Constitution by refusing to leave office on January 20th next year, if assuming Biden wins, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, it's an open letter op-ed to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley. He says the chairman of the Joint Chiefs must issue the order to remove Trump from office. And so that's what the military should do. Everyone who serves in uniform, they take an oath to protect the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. They are defenders of the Constitution. This is their view of their mind. That's a big fucking deal. Corey Shockey and Jim Golby. Jim used to serve in the military. I think he's like a Stanford PhD. And then Corey is a scholar who focuses on defense stuff. She's at AEI, which is like a liberal, neoliberal think tank. And they argue that this is crazy town, that it basically what Nagel and Yingling are arguing for is unconstitutional. And
yeah,
it's very fucking unconstitutional. I have some thoughts about this, but I wanted to, what does this look like to, you know, people who are not Americans?
Nagel and Yingling did some like quite interesting rhetorical plays in their piece where they, you know, characterized the, I don't know, the ICE agents or the unidentified federal officers who have been deployed to like Portland, for example, as Trump's private army, which is true to in like
it's sort
the
of
most
true, yeah,
abstract sense of the term, but they're only, and I'm sure there's lots of sympathy among those agents for Trump, but also like they're responding to his validly given and held federal authority. And so characterizing them as a private army answerable to Trump the individual, which is a large part of the justification of their piece, was really weird. There were lots of just like rhetorical plays like that, which when you interrogated them didn't make much sense, but added up to like a, you know, a compelling narrative. If I was a retired lieutenant colonel and distinguished member of the American foreign policy establishment, I don't know if I'd have been as keen to crash and burn my reputation by relying on kind of like fraudulent rhetorical plays.
Is the fact that this is even a conversation, like the fact that this conversation is even happening, does this prove that people truly think Trump's going to pull this? That I mean, he's just not going to leave?
So he's right now, he's actively doing things that in any other context would be illegal and then the law would be enforced, right? But because of his position and because of his impunity, all these measures that he's taking right now to literally undermine the election, right? Like stacking the post office, defunding the post office, fucking it up so that it can't do its function as a reliable source of mail-in voting, which is how everyone's going to have to vote in the pandemic. And then he's already publicly said that, well, the U.S. Postal Service is fucked up. He's actually actively fucking it up. So we might have to suspend the election. So he's looking for all kinds of ways, and he's actively doing it to prevent the election from going smoothly, transparently. As by extension, it's not unreasonable to think that he will try to stay in office even if Biden wins the Electoral College, even if Biden gets the votes needed. The problem to me is, like, I mean, one thing that I have to say about this whole like military coup stuff is that there's a bunch of talk about it. There has been for a long time. I don't know if you heard of the Lincoln Project. It's like these Republican Never Trumpers, sort of like Colin Powell types, and they're basically neoliberals and neocons, but they take liberalism so seriously that, you know, they'd be willing to create a deep state where there is not one, kind of thing. And that goes all the way up to a military coup, apparently. But like, they've been wargaming all these different scenarios. Okay, he's like, okay, if it's a muddled outcome, if Biden wins the popular vote but not the Electoral College, if he wins the Electoral College and then Trump doesn't leave, if Trump pushes the election. So like, they've walked through all these scenarios and then how the Democrats would likely respond, how the public would respond, how the GOP and Trump and his quislings would respond. And so like, this is a real thing. And Nagle is plugged into that. I don't think this is a one-off from just him. I think there's like a bunch of people who feel this way. But the Corey Shockey and Jim Golby piece prove what I saw on Twitter, which is like, this is a very divisive perspective. Like, there are lots of people in uniform, former people, you know, in uniform like me, who have lots of major concerns about raising something like this. One of the major problems here is that, I mean, this sounds technocratic, but like, it's not trivial. Mark Milley, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, technically he's the senior most military officer, but the chairman is not invested with authority to give orders to the military. So he's the senior military advisor to the Secretary of Defense. That's his role. And so it would be a giant fucking unconstitutional power grab for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs to start issuing orders to the military. To do that in the context of like trying to assume power is just doubly problematic. And the real solution here is like, if Biden wins the Electoral College, it is the military's job, and it is Milley's job as well, to obey Biden's orders. If Biden says Trump is a domestic enemy of the state and he's sitting in my chair, get him out of there. If Biden were to say that, then it's a legit move. They're following the orders of the commander in chief. But that's not that isn't necessary that doesn't have to happen. You know, I'm imagining that Biden would not go to the military option first. So like, there is an important military function here, which is to basically do nothing, follow orders of the person who wins the election. And so that's it. And you can, somebody on Twitter, Dave Burback at the Naval War College, he said something like, if we had to physically remove Trump from office because he just won't fucking go, it's much better to have like the Secret Service or the park police do that and arrest him for trespassing.
Right.
He's just some orange guy who's squatting after January 20th if he loses. So this doesn't need to go to a military coup.
I mean, maybe is this going to be his sort of last laugh? Because if it does have to go to a coup, that's essentially going to gut all the legitimacy from the administration purely because they had to go to a coup. And that's not something that, in the current position, it's not something that the United States can really afford to do.
Yeah.
Is further delegitimize whatever apparatus they have.
If you use the military to do this, you're basically giving up on the Constitution. And the irony is that the justification.
You can't go back from it.
Yeah. The irony is that the justification is the Constitution. It is your oath of service. So like, the meta problem here to me is kind of like the military version of cowboy cop romanticism.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, can we have one problem in America where the answer is not the fucking military? Like, just one, you know? Fucking, you know, we got a pandemic. We need more F-35s. We got a presidential problem. Oh, well, the military needs to fucking solve that. Terrorism, fucking military. Everything's fucking military, man.
It is. It really is.
Yeah. This is the militarist's mindset. You know, the one thing that I would say for this piece, the reason why I'm like a little ambivalent, it's not because like I oppose a military coup. Let's be clear. I'm afraid of like the Weimar Germany kind of like the fact that liberals have so much faith in their institutions. They have so much faith in their fellow man. And then they just get steamrolled by people with superior resolve. Like, I'm worried about that. It's like for the past 3 years, everybody on the morning talk shows and stuff, they completely act like, well, Trump would never do something so beyond the pale that to reject the election or stay in office. And it's like clearly that he's willing to do that if he thinks he can get away with it. And so I'm afraid of like the liberals' optimism bias, basically. And so there needs to be serious resolve on the liberals' side. And I mean, the whole military coup thing is a form of resolve. It's not the form of resolve that I would prefer.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them. All right, Prediction Market this week. Question one, will the Biden-Harris campaign announce any major foreign policy before the end of this month? And this month being August.
Yeah, Kamala. This is big news.
It is.
Yeah.
Huge deal.
So I'm gonna say no, but the reason, I think, is that, you know, Harris does not have a foreign policy profile to speak of. You know, I think I mentioned on the pod before, like when she was running for president, I was one of her volunteer foreign policy advisors. And so I'm not in a position to be able to say anything about her that's not already like public information. But what I can say is that she hasn't said anything about foreign policy that looks different from Biden. And Biden, the only way he engages in foreign policy right now is on China. And it's only to sort of push back on Trump's weird Oriental McCarthyism or whatever, you know, pushing back on the Clash of Civilizations narrative while also trying to appear tough on China, which risks being a trap in itself. But that it's the China issue that's kind of a wedge. But other than that, like, you're just not seeing anything on foreign policy because it's not a big driver right now of the campaign. So I'm going to say no.
I'm just really... Like, I'm not even religious, but at this point I'm praying that Biden can make one policy announcement without making a gaffe straight after. Like, he's every single policy announcement that he's been given the opportunity to make, he's just stuffed it up by saying something stupid.
You know, obviously these guys have my fucking vote, right? But it is depressing as fuck and super anti-inspiring, or whatever the opposite of inspiring is, when I see these like basically YouTube videos in the staged fake presidential office, and he's like wearing the mask and he's talking to an audience of zero. There's something that feels just wildly dystopian about all of it. And removing the crowd from politics, especially because like Biden is such a glad-handing kind of guy, really just like destroys the energy. Like, I fucking like, I hate seeing the videos. Kamala Harris's speech she gave the other day, was like, when this was announced, was great in the sense of like it went after Trump aggressively and she's going to be an attack dog, and that is very needed, I think. But I don't know, the performativity of running for president in an age of Zoom is not cool to watch.
Out of curiosity, real quick, Van, you mentioned that this like foreign policy really isn't like the biggest thing that they're focusing on right now. Like, do you think we're going to see it at any, I don't know, how do you say it, like commitment or anything to foreign policy before? Like,
no, not really. I mean, like,
just the entire time.
I'm saying no, but then like the China thing is a big deal, and the China thing is something that Biden and his advisors are constantly hitting. Like, that's it. The GOP. Issued the Republican National Senatorial Committee issued guidance several months ago to all the Republican campaigns, and they said, look, you should, rather than try and defend Trump, which is just an impossible task, focus your energy on aggressively attacking China, on villainizing China and on portraying Biden and the Democrats as weak on China. So like their strategy, the Republican strategy, is to focus their laser energies on China. So in that sense, that is a huge foreign policy issue, and it's front and center in the campaign. But it's like the only one. It seems to be driven by nothing to do with geopolitical strategy and everything to do with domestic political strategy. Oh, not for nothing. So, this is fucking, I don't want to get too sidetracked. I saw that National Party issued a fucking manifesto where they said one of their goals was to double trade with China by 2030. Double trade?
Yeah.
The Friends of Fascism Initiative. What the fuck? They took it off their website after I made a, not because I made a stink about it, but after I made a stink about it. So it's, you can't find it online right now, but I saw it before they took it down. And it's fucking like, Jesus fucking Christ.
All right. Question two. Will Serbia continue pursuing the possibility of purchasing Chinese FK3 air defense missile system before December?
Yeah, I think so. Serbia has been.
Oh, shit, man.
They're like the weak link in the EU when it comes to China stuff. Like when the pandemic first hit, the president of Serbia made all these like gross ingratiating remarks about Xi Jinping. He declared there is no EU. Solidarity is fake. Yeah. He is in China's camp firmly. He's bought. He's clearly corrupted. And I don't think he cares about America's civilizational conflict with China. Or if he does, he cares in the sense that he's on China's side. So, yeah.
Well, it's really interesting because people, I've seen a lot of talk about Belarus recently.
Yeah.
And the protests happening in Belarus. But the president of Serbia has been a dictator currently for almost half a year. Alexander Vucic.
Yeah.
He's been a dictator for most of this year. And he done it through a military coup in all the dictatorial ways you expect. And now he's buying Chinese weapons and they still want to be a member of the EU. Like, what are they trying to do?
I know.
Like, am I missing something?
No, I mean, parts of Eastern Europe, like there was this big narrative after the Cold War that Eastern Europe flipped to democracy and it's like happy time, end of history and all that shit. And like Eastern Europe was like the proof of the end of history in the minds of like so many people. And it's Eastern Europe that is like the most quickly kind of eroding or reversing politically here. And so this poses a hard test for the EU in certain ways.
Question three, will the United States veto United Nations peacekeeping actions in Lebanon, citing concerns over the influence of Hezbollah before November?
This is so fucking crazy. And I think,
I hope they don't.
I think the answer might be yes, man. the UN peacekeeping mission in Lebanon has been there since the 70s. And it's there because Israel invaded fucking Lebanon. And so the peacekeeping force was like this armistice-y kind of way to maintain stability and like pull back from conflict, but without any kind of permanent resolution to the thing. And it's actually UNIFIL, the name of the peacekeeping force. It's held up frequently in research about peacekeeping as like this great success case. It's like proof of how peacekeeping is so effective, but it has such a limited scope and mandate that it can't possibly solve every problem. And Israel, everybody probably knows, like Israel basically attacked Lebanon in 2006 because they were trying to go after Hezbollah. But so like Lebanon was just a place or like a, you know, kind of a victim. But Israel attacked Hezbollah in Lebanon, so effectively attacked Lebanon. And it's like the Lebanese government either couldn't or wouldn't do anything to not give sanctuary to Hezbollah. And so this is all happening in the presence of UN peacekeeping forces. And so the Trump administration is hijacking that reality to say that the peacekeepers are not doing their job and therefore they should be either, you know, defunded or reduced in scope, reduced in size, like of peacekeepers, not warfighters, right? Peacekeepers. Very problematic.
I hate to throw another hat in the ring, but speaking of Israel, Gabby let me know today that the BBC's just reported that Israel and the United Arab Emirates have struck a historic peace deal. What's happening?
Well, you know, the U.S. has improperly good relations with the UAE, and the UAE funds all kinds of, you know, Aspen Institute think tanky kind of shit. Like, U.S. foreign policy is in service of the UAE all the time. We sell so much arms to them. It's fucking like, so the UAE has been very pro-Trump. It's always had a close kind of like defense and foreign policy relationship with the U.S., much to my chagrin. I've never gotten or taken or received UAE money.
Why not, man? Why not?
Well, so, so technically, they've never offered it to me directly, but
all right, go.
Lack of opportunity, more like, you know.
And so,
I haven't taken corrupt bribes. Yeah, haven't been offered, but
I've neither taken nor been offered. So there's so much money at play with the UAE, and it's like, to me, it is corrupt. And I'm sort of saying that lamentably because it means I'm preemptively foreclosing on ever getting UAE money. But the, like, as you know, if I'm clear-eyed about this, it is broadly corrupt. Like, there are things you can do with the UAE that are not just pure militarism or not supporting dictatorship, but you have to go through some like logical jujitsu to get there. So hopefully I don't eat my words soon. Oh, but the reason I'm bringing that up is because like they're pro-Trump, UAE, and so is Israel. Among the Gulf countries, I think the Trump administration's sort of corrupted foreign policy relationship is closest with the UAE. So there is, even though it seems weird that like UAE and Israel would be together in a U.S. foreign policy sense, that's not crazy.
Well, in case they're listening, United Arab Emirates, I don't have the same moral hang-ups Van does. So, I mean, hit me up.
Thank you.
There's prediction market this week.
Great.
Time for Say Off Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
So, Stay Off Twitter this week, I've got three, but they're all quick. One is from Tom Lee, who is an assistant professor at Pomona College, which is like my dream job. And he says, China hawks who are never Trumpers must really be conflicted. Love seeing Trump turn the screws on China, but you have to eat a global trade war. I actually wrote a piece for Foreign Policy that should be coming out around the same time that this episode comes out. And it basically says almost what this tweet says, except it's in 2000 word form instead of 140 characters or whatever. Basically, like, liberal internationalism is of two minds about China. Biden is of two minds about China. And what we're seeing in the Trump era is one aspect of liberalism, which is like individual rights, political liberalism, quote unquote freedom, being prioritized over economic liberalism. In the neoliberal Hayekian Alan Greenspan, like, greed is good, state is bad kind of liberalism. And so, like, liberal internationalism has always been of two minds, always been Janus faced. There's always this like uneasiness about how these two liberal values like coexist, but America makes it work on the back of, you know, military superiority and all that shit. And what's happening under Trump is like, you know, nobody really cares about logical consistency or like, you know, faithfulness to the ideology, uneasy as it is. And so political liberalism is winning out as part of like this whole clash of civilizations thing. But like a lot of the China hawks that are supporting Trump's policies on China, they are the Heritage Foundation types. They are the American Enterprise Institute types. They are neoliberals, right? Neocons are neoliberals. China plus Trump is forcing these neocon neoliberals to choose being neocon over being neoliberal. I don't know what's worse, but there's definitely like a contradiction here that Tom is pointing out, which I thought was good. I've kind of come around to the view that the claim that the economic sphere is apolitical is the ultimate political pose. Like, there's nothing more political than saying this area of our political life should be apolitical. And so, like, I think they're trying to Trump route maneuver political arguments that the left makes. I'm not, like, anti-liberal. I'm just, like, I'm aware of its limitations, I guess.
Well, one facilitates the other, right? So, like, a global international liberal order will facilitate the world trade that allows liberal economics to work So that's what I more mean when you can't really separate the two.
It's an interesting segue to the next tweet, actually, from a history professor at the University of Southampton, Jonathan Hunt. We're Twitter pen pals. And he just he says, I'm glad we're all patting ourselves on the back for being better than ellipses, the People's Republic of China. There's going to be an election and China will return to a foreign policy challenge rather than a get out of jail free card for the very clear defects in our republic. And this is giving a nod to the fact that, like, right now, especially Trump people and China hawks, but like even the Democrats are basically using China as this attention grabbing kind of scapegoat for most of our problems and for most of America's problems and the problems of American foreign policy. It's like, well, as long as the China threat is so big and bad and foregrounded, you know, you don't have to face tough questions about corruption in your own foreign policy. The fact that American foreign policy is rent seeking from allies, the fact that you have a military establishment that still requires a $680 billion fucking budget, the fact that you're gutting arms control, because like all these things and more, unstoppable fucking race problem in all things American, all of this stuff is like, we are not coming to terms with ourselves. Like, we're refusing a reckoning. And this was something that happened in the, I don't want to fucking go off on a tangent here, in the Cold War. Like, Cold War liberals were of the mind that, like, the priority was to stop the Soviet Union. The priority was to, like, protect freedom in that way. And that justified the behemoth national security state. That justified a militarist mindset. And it was by a lot of people who were liberals, who were social democrats, but they never, like, defended those positions. Their focus was the Soviet Union. And like freedom and all that shit. And so they weren't defending the welfare state. They weren't standing up for democracy in the sense of like arguing for democracy. They were arguing against the Soviet Union. And that created like a back door for the like Alan Greenspan neoliberal types to come in at the end of the Cold War. And that's how we get third way liberalism with Clinton. And that's the beginning of the end of fucking everything. Sorry, that's like Van Jackson's interpretation of history. But like, it's just very problematic. And so like what's happening again right now with the China stuff, like, you know, I'm basically a China hawk. I'm fucking anti-China. They fucking suck. They're committing a genocide. They're a real threat. They're trying to build a fucking empire. But how we deal with that matters. And like the way that it's being dealt with right now by like just foregrounding them as the Cold War kind of threat is it's deprioritizing a reckoning in our own foreign policy, making our own foreign policy more democratic, more egalitarian. It's a problem.
Is there something to be said, kind of, this might sound kind of mean, but is there something to be said in terms of the fact that they always have to keep referring to China every time they do something bad? So it's kind of like, oh, so we did a bad thing, but at least it's not bad as, you know, this tenfold awful thing in China to compare. Yeah. To.
Well, yes, kids in cages, but it's the genocide in Xinjiang. That's what we should be concerned about. And like, this is the fucking, so like putting aside whether moral equivalency is a tactic or correct or wrong, Trump himself green-lighted Xi Jinping turning Hong Kong into a colony. Trump himself told Xi Jinping that internment camps for Uyghurs was a good and necessary idea. His words, man.
Yeah, that's true.
Pompeo gives these like civilizational existential threat speeches. So that my foreign policy piece addresses some of this stuff and it should hit the same time as the pod again. But this, like, the administration and the China hawks are saying one thing, and if they took their own rhetoric seriously, Trump would be an enemy of the state. Trump is the one who is like emboldening and accelerating these Chinese actions that we think are so evil. And so like there's a huge cognitive dissonance going on that is just like fucking possible, and it's so frustrating to look at. Anyways, shout out to Jonathan Hunt. Third quick tweet from Dan Nexon, friend of the pod, professor at Georgetown. This is simple, true, clear. The sad truth is that if all a Biden-Harris administration does is roll back some Trump's deregulations, it will be a massive win for progressive policy goals. And that's true. And that's why they got my vote, man. it's sad in the sense that like the bar is quite low, but being progressive or not, it's not this binary thing. It's a spectrum, and you want to be moving in the right direction, and they are definitely the right direction. And if you view it in two binary or two black and white terms, you're just in Trump's world, you know? There's going to be political pressure from the left for them to do some things, but it's going to be the token gestures toward the left. It's not going to be like an actually progressive administration, I don't think. But in relative terms, it's going to be wildly yeah. progressive. It's going to be fucking utopia compared to Trump. Anyways, yeah. thought this was good. Brookings actually, next and links to it in the tweet, Brookings Institution has a deregulation tracker in the Trump era where you can actually look at all the regulations and instructions and rules basically on business that Trump has undone to create, as again, like the nod to the neoliberal side of liberalism in the worst sense.
Sweet. Two pretty solid tweets for the week. The first comes from Adam Mount, who's the director over at the Defense Posture Project mm-hmm. for the Federation of American Scientists. He's replying to the news that Seoul will not rule out taking action to stop radio stations run by human rights activists broadcasting into North Korea. And should there be future problems, the government may actually weigh up activists' right to free expressions with the concerns of the South Korean people, which is like, for sure, a big, can you do that kind of thing? But like Mao puts it more eloquently than that, obviously, saying in his tweet, if a government is balancing your rights against other considerations, it is no longer respecting them as rights.
Booyah. I thought this was really good, not just because of the take, but because this issue is getting like no attention. Basically, it's notionally a progressive South Korean government right now, or at least that's the image. They are cracking down on the North Korean defector community and all those who support the North Korean defector community. And this is very perverted because it's kind of like a suppression of human rights in South Korea. And yeah. it's because in the like weirdest fucking way possible, it's the South Korean progressives are aligned with North Korea's view on these things. And North Korea's view of defectors is pretty harsh, obviously, right? They're yeah. traitors. And North Korean defectors in South Korean society in general are not, they're stigmatized. They're not welcome. They're considered as like an other. They're not fully Korean, or they're not really Korean kind of thing. And so they face all kinds of discrimination just at a societal level. But, you know, what the Moon administration is doing here is actively taking measures that are targeted at a minority group, basically, which is undemocratic. That violates a certain principle of liberalism. You know, like protections for minorities yeah. is built into liberalism. And this is undoing that. And it's ironic and not getting attention because of the banner of like peace initiative and all this other stuff that they talk about with North Korea. So it's good for people on the left, which Adam Mount is, to call out the hypocrisy.
Yeah, I was going to say, especially like the Moon administration going through all these hoops, I suppose, to kind of just prove themselves or whatever to North Korea, just being like, oh, we are on your side. I mean, what are the chances of them actually, they're saying that they're like weighing it up now, but what are the chances that they'll actually push forward with this action instead of just talk?
No, they're going to, it's within their South Korean borders. Like they're going to investigate the NGOs that are tied to North Korea in South Korea. And when I say tied to North Korea, I mean like they are human rights NGOs. They're the ones who harass North Korea about their North Korea's human rights problems. It's like if you were to do an investigation of Amnesty International in order to sabotage them and bring them down. Like that's what that's like. Or we're going to investigate Human Rights Watch so we can shut them down. That's what this is, basically.
Jumping into my next tweet, friend of the pod, Hunter Marston. Hunter. Really hope you aren't getting sick of me shouting you out, Mr. Marston. But his tweet reads, remember that poll that showed less than 60% of ASEAN respondents saying their confidence in the U.S. as a strategic partner and regional security provider will increase if Trump loses in November? Biden seems to be really tapping into that sentiment, promising he will show up. And if you guys check out this tweet, he also links a report with it all, like in a thread. But like this tweet, right? So firstly, fascinating to see the hard data showing just how much the confidence in America has deteriorated. I mean, I'm trying to say that as nicely as possible. But secondly, Van, do you think Biden will pull through and taking advantage of that sentiment, like to show up? Or is he just like talking out of his ass right now?
I think in this, the Tony Blinken, senior advisor for Biden's campaign, he was deputy secretary of state under Obama. He made a tweet that was clearly drafted by somebody else where it's like, congratulations to ASEAN, blah, blah, ASEAN centrality. And it is on message. Like, that's what you want to see and hear, right? And that's what Hunter is kind of responding to. And I think that tweet is proof of what my sense is anyways, which is that like the Biden folks, they take seriously the kind of regional architecture of Asia and as a source of stability. And while U.S. alliances are like number one in Southeast Asia, number one is ASEAN. And so and ASEAN is like a very performative, symbolic kabuki theater kind of institution, but it does the job. Like, that's, you know, like, why would you undermine it? Even if you think it's not super effective, you know, is it costing you anything to go through the theater, to like give the formality, the obligation, the nod toward ASEAN to say like, yes, you know, like we value you, we center you, ASEAN centrality. Like, you are the foremost consideration in Southeast Asian international relations. You know, like, that's an important statement, particularly for an outside great power, particularly for a great power that killed lots of Southeast Asians during the Cold War. America doesn't have like great moral standing in Southeast Asia. And it's remarkable, almost generous that, you know, like Singapore, Indonesia, Philippines, like bothers to keep us around or like bothers to value us in the region, you know? It's all the thing I loved about Hunter's tweet though, was like 60% of ASEAN respondents, which I had not seen this survey before, but like, they say that their confidence in the U.S. as a partner will increase if the president loses. So, like, let that sink in, you know? We need the leadership of U.S. foreign policy to leave, and we will feel much better. That is literally what they're saying. I think foreign policy monks should take note.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
Yeah, so we'll jump right in to Armchair Analysis this week with a piece from the Boston Review by Edward Fishman called The Death and Rebirth of American Internationalism. And it's a review of The Light That Failed, Why the West is Losing the Fight for Democracy, a book by Ivan Krastev and Stephen Holmes, two political scientists. And the piece starts off by saying that many in the US foreign policy establishment were hoping that the Trump administration would be a bad dream, a kind of, you know, just an interregnum, and then we'd return to normal. And they had good reason to think that would be the case, because for the past 30 years, since the end of the Cold War, the United States has had a largely consistent foreign policy aim to universalize the order that survived the fall of the Berlin Wall, this kind of liberal universalism. That's obviously not happening anymore. Trump has decisively ended that 30-year history. And Washington's and Trump's, flailing response to COVID-19 has been the nail in the coffin, calling into question the basic competence of the American state and the cohesion of American society. And so what Krastev and Holmes try and do in the book is to imagine not only a successor to liberal universalism, but understand why liberal universalism floundered and founded as a project. And Fishman gives them a lot of credit for the work, that there were a number of things that they just don't quite get. But basically what Krastev and Holmes do is they try and ask not what went wrong, but what if we were wrong about America's post-Cold War foreign policy. And they say that liberal universalism was bound to generate resentment, that liberal leaders overseas like Orban and Putin kind of bristled at the implicit moral hierarchy which liberal universalism created, which placed the United States and Western Europe on this kind of pedestal, which, you know, encouraged brain drain from the imitating countries to the imitated, and which robbed the imitators of their agency because they were copying policy rather than creating policy and forging their own destiny. And Fishman says that that's persuasive but misleading for a number of reasons. Firstly, because while the authors insist that liberal leaders lack a universally exportable ideology, that ignores the work and aspiration of leaders like Orban, who has been very clear that he wants to create a world in which his version of a liberal democracy is comfortable. And Fishman also criticizes them for giving short shrift to economics, and in particular the rise of neoliberal market economics. The book apparently makes only one vague reference to it, but Fishman argues that the rise of neoliberal market economics explains why Western officials counseled former Warsaw Pact states to adopt neoliberal economic models and engage in that kind of so-called shock therapy, and left local leaders with little room for kind of homegrown policies. But even more profoundly, that neoliberalism had the greatest influence on US foreign policy through gutting the United States itself, gutting government services, producing soaring inequality and social dislocation, and destroying the global appeal of the American model. So in essence, what this article is saying is that in the telling of Krastevin Holmes, the fatal flaw of liberal universalism was that it divided the world in two, separating imitators from the imitated. But it's one step removed, according to Fishman, from the original sin of liberal universalism, the implication that the West's own political and particularly economic development was complete, which encouraged this kind of complacency and messianic behavior. We can take different conclusions from that, according to the article. And in particular, the article says that the lesson we should take from the light that failed is not that US foreign policy after the Cold War was too focused on ideas, nor is it that Washington would be best served by reverting to cold-blooded realpolitik. It is just that US post-Cold War foreign policy was too focused on universalism. And so US foreign policy, according to Fishman, taking the lessons of the light that failed, is that US foreign policy should seek to remake the liberal world that already exists instead of proceeding on the abortive mission of converting the whole world to liberalism. I thought this was a really, I mean, I always say this, I thought this was a really interesting article, mainly because I didn't know how I came out on it. It was, I found the diagnosis of both Krastevin Holmes and Fishman really compelling, but the prescriptions, I was kind of, I really had to take a step back and think about it. I mean, what did you think about it, Ben?
That's pretty close to me. So as a critique and as a diagnosis of like the what went wrong and centering neoliberal economics as something that is both profoundly political in as an action, but also as like the implications of it, the consequences, the way it drove inequality, the way it censored sovereignty of other countries, especially developing countries, post-colonial states. All of that, I think, is correct, valid, good. I think this is an important understanding of history to have. Liberal universalism was problematic, foremost the neoliberal driving of it. The fact that in Washington, literally, it was called the Washington Consensus. The belief, the conventional wisdom that we needed to convince other states to deregulate their economies. And if they did, then they could have aid. Then they could have balance of payments support. Then they could have trade agreements, right? And that is telling them what to do with their politics, right? Yeah, oh, well, it creates greater unemployment in your country. Fucking eat it. It's apolitical, right? It's like, this is the economics. The sanctity of the economic sphere must be beyond politics. So if you have to eat inequality and you have to have homelessness and inflation or whatever, that's your problem, man. That's the price of being apolitical. But like, what could be more political than that? You know, like this is fucking on theme with what I was talking about earlier in the episode. The thing that where I thought this fell down, which maybe Pete, this is what you were saying, but like, I didn't see a positive case. Okay, so you're against liberal universalism. Got it. What does it mean to remake the liberal world that already exists? Like, what the fuck? What is that? I can't even make up stuff. Like, I don't know what that means.
It's also like, I mean, remaking the, so that, I think that really encapsulates my concern really well. And I think particularly, it's like remaking the liberal world could also be just like doubling down on neoliberalism, right? Like it's so
yes,
it's unbelievably vague that you're just like, you need to have a really cohesive vision as opposed to a critique, which is what I've loved about the discussions we've been having on previous podcasts about like building a strong anti-corruption case for, you know, a new foreign policy or focusing on a progressive liberal world community where you can have that kind of positive vision, an uplifting vision where people are engaged and want to participate as opposed to feeling like something's being forced onto them.
Yes. And that would be remaking, like if you have an agenda based on principles of strengthening equality, you know, within a country, but also between, you know, the global north and the global south or whatever, anti-kleptocracy, like all this anti-imperialism. If you have that kind of agenda, that would be remaking the liberal world that already exists. And that is obviously like what we're all about. But like, based on how this thing is worded, it's like Trump could be the champion of remaking the liberal world that already exists. You know, like he is he's not exporting liberal universalism. And so like there just needed to be more of like an agenda, or the prescriptions thing has left me dissatisfied, I guess. All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
This week for Ask Me Anything, we have two questions. The first one is from Patrick Foran, a friend of the pod at the University of Missouri. Are you more of a Waltzian nuclear optimist or a Sagan nuclear pessimist? I am really looking forward to the answer to this question.
Yeah, so the thing that's important to know is that the Sagan view of these things. So for one thing, Sagan is like an informal mentor of mine. He has, you know, given me opportunities. He endorsed my last book. He's a really nice guy and he's smart. Having put all that aside, his view of nuclear proliferation is the view of the foreign policy communities, not just in Washington, but everywhere. It presupposes his view. Everybody, for a generation, all foreign policy when it comes to nuclear nonproliferation is based on the premise that more is worse, that the spread of nukes is bad, right? So he has wide popular buy-in. And I'm obviously of that school. From a policy standpoint, I argue from a place of Scott Sagan. The reason I do it, though, is because it's the job of the statesman or stateswoman to try and manage risks on behalf of society. And the way you manage nuclear risks is through arms control. It's through a presumption that more will be worse, right? That's so like, it's about prudence and stability. But I think in an academic sense, this is going to be like heresy. I think the Waltzian argument is actually more analytically compelling. It's very hard. Sagan doesn't really refute Waltz's logic. He just points out the risks. Waltz is probably right that deterrence is easy because the costs of deterrence failure are so high, so stability is assured. And like those things are probably true, but they're not assured. They're not guaranteed. And so there's always going to be a risk of use. And the more nukes that are out there, you're multiplying that risk across nuclear dyads, across new nuclear states, you know, and shit happens. Like Sagan's argument is basically shit happens, and the consequences of nukes being that shit are so devastating that like we have to do everything we can to sort of tamp down on that risk, you know. Like it's like almost like probability is on Waltz's side, but probability is not what we're concerned about as policymakers. We're concerned about risk. And so it's like, even if there's like a 5% risk, well, that may align with like the Waltzian view, but a 5% risk is something that as policymakers, we need to try and buy down a little bit if we can, you know? So that's sort of my take.
Okay. So this week is from Anonymous. Now that Kamala Harris is Biden's VP, will you go work for her?
No. I don't know what else to say.
That was what a fucking sad question.
No. In coronavirus fucking United States, are you kidding me? Like, I don't see it, you know? I don't see it. Also, I don't think they need me. So, all right, gang, that's going to do it. WPR.pub/undiplomatic for the World Politics Review newsletter. Our sponsor, buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic to give us money for random reasons. And we'll see you next time.
Peace.